while ignoring the information and experiences that contradict it. Although Sharon was often praised for her excellent work and told how valuable she was to the team of attorneys she was associated with, she could not hold on to those positive experiences in situations that reminded her of her childhood. For Sharon, even neutral situations or statements were interpreted as negatives, reinforcing her unimportance once again. After years of holding the dominant negative thought, "I'm not important," and feeling the anger and sadness that accompanied that thought, Sharon's core belief had become so strong that she no longer questioned it. She accepted it and vigilantly looked for and listened for evidence to support what she was taught to believe. Since we always get what we expect, Sharon found more than enough evidence in her daily life to motivate self-sabotaging behaviors like remaining silent, acting invisible, and isolating. Dominant negative thought patterns are often so ingrained in consciousness that people are often totally unaware that these patterns have become a core belief, a permanent filter through which the individual see themselves and the world. In fact, many people argue against their own dominant negative thought patterns and core beliefs by mentally jumping to the opposite end of the continuum just to prove that they don't believe what they actually do believe. In this way, they create a polarized thought pattern to contradict the discomfort of their core beliefs. For example, Andy, like Sharon, held an unconscious core belief that he was not important. He contradicted and camouflaged his supposed inadequacy by acting out with a sense of entitlement and arrogance. Andy decided that his needs, wants, opinions, and desires were superior to those of others and had to be accommodated at all costs. This inflated behavior, motivated by the need to prove his importance, began to strike others as aggressive. In fact, over time, Andy was regarded as a bully. Attempts to cover up the unconscious core belief and the dominant negative thought patterns that create them can result in extremely polarized beliefs and behaviors. Thoughts and consequences. Something happens which triggers you to have a thought. The thought you have generates a feeling, a sensation that moves throughout your body. Depending upon the energy of the feeling, you behave in a particular way. In the midst of this reaction, you have a series of other thoughts, some of which you are aware of, others of which you are not. Each of your conscious and unconscious thoughts has a feeling attached to it, a feeling that either motivates or restricts your behavior. Alternatively, you may have a feeling, a sensation that moves throughout your body that gives rise to a thought. That thought then motivates you to behave in a particular way, to do or not do something, which prompts a series of other thoughts, and the cycle continues. Regardless of which comes first, the thought or the feeling, this vastly simplified version of how the mind works happens thousands of times per minute, whether or not you are aware that it is going on. Everything we think, say, or do is attached to something we have heard, seen, or done. That's just the way it works. The brain stores information. The scent of your grandmother's house, your child's first cry, the exact shade of blue of a certain dress, the flavor of a ripe tomato. Our memories compose those experiences that have already unfolded in our lives. Memories give us a sense of who and what we are in the world. The mind works to tie our past to our present in order to provide a framework for how we interpret the future. It is this process of storing and referencing a collective set of memories that makes us who we are. This all works fine and dandy when the memories stored are powerful, productive, and familiar. The challenge comes when our past was disjointed, dysfunctional, or traumatic. Things can be even more difficult when we face the certainty of the unknown. When something unknown or unfamiliar comes to us, how we receive it, respond to it, or react because of it is determined by what is already present in our consciousness. Scientists guesstimate that 99% of what we perceive about the world around us is a function of what is already present in our minds. This is supported and explained by A Course in Miracles, Lesson 2, which states, "I have given everything I see all the meaning it has for me." The meanings we give to people, situations, circumstances, and experiences is almost always directed and dictated by our dominant thought patterns, whether positive or negative. For the purposes of the get over it process, we will focus on negative thought patterns. Those are the ones that make it hard for us to move beyond the places that we are familiar with or stuck in. Miss Claudacious Putting It In. Allow me to introduce you to Miss Claudie Putting It In. She lives in your brain. In fact, she lives in the brain of every single human being on the planet. Miss Claudie, a 65-year-old spinster librarian, works 24 hours a day. She's never been in love, never had a lover. Needless to say, she's wound a bit tight. She doesn't get out much because she's totally committed to her work. Allow her image to fill your mind right now. She's about 5'2" and slim in stature. She hasn't been shopping in quite a while and has never wasted a dime on a fashion magazine. Every single day of her life, she wears a plaid skirt, a pinstripe blouse, and a cardigan sweater with a top button buttoned. She wears support stockings and laced-up orthopedic shoes. You know the kind with the puffy round toes. Her 27-inch long salt and pepper hair is arranged neatly in a bun at the back of her head. This is where she sticks her pencils, paper clips, and an occasional pack of gum to keep her going throughout the day. Of course she wears glasses, and when she's not wearing them, they hang from a black cord around her neck. She swears by the Playtex Cross Your Heart bra because it makes her very small breasts appear to be very pointy. Can you see her? Do you feel her presence? Miss Claudie's job is to file every thought, feeling, belief, word, and experience that you've ever had into the filing cabinet of your mind. She does this second by second, minute by minute, every day of your life. Her work began the moment you were first able to feel and respond to a sensation, even when you didn't possess language to describe your experiences. In other words, her work began when you were in the womb. The first files that Miss Claudie created for you were in response to what your mother was thinking or feeling, which in turn created a sensation in your body. This is an important reference point because some of the sensations you respond to in your present life may very well have nothing to do with you. You may still be reacting to thoughts or feelings your mother had that you picked up as sensations prior to your birth. Your every womb time wiggle or twitch, whether pleasant or not, was labeled and filed by Miss Claudie. At first, she used simple words based on her long-term knowledge and connection to the human experience. Words like happy or sad and good or bad were the only categories she needed when you were an infant. The moment you developed language skills, she began to associate words to thoughts and feelings. However, her work became much more complex. Anything and everything you experienced had to be classified by feelings and thoughts, then placed in a file labeled with the associated dominant energy. When you were hungry, when you fell off the bed, when you heard somebody screaming, not at you, but around you, Miss Claudie selected an existing file or, when necessary, created a new file, then tucked that thought or feeling inside. On those occasions when you were young and very active, a time when you kept her extremely busy, she may have misfiled certain things, placing some thoughts or feelings in an already existing file, one for familiar or a similar feeling experience. The good thought files became the home for thoughts you had following good, very good, and awesome experiences because your body generated similar feeling reactions or energies in response to them. The unhappy thought files became the home for thoughts you had following sad, lonely, and unhappy experiences because your body generated similar feeling reactions and energies to those experiences. She created files for other thoughts and feelings as well, those prompted by anger, fear, jealousy, regret, and so forth. The older you got and the more sophisticated your thought processes became, the more dominant energy categories Miss Claudie had to sort through to find the files she needed. Around the time you turned 6 years old, Miss Claudie had to streamline her process to keep up with the work of maintaining the filing system within your mind. She began to rely totally on the sensations associated with your experiences to determine into which file your thoughts and feelings should be placed. It may have become a little sloppy, but Miss Claudie is, after all, up there in age and needing to classify and file roughly 70,000 thoughts per day created a great deal of running back and forth between file cabinets. Needless to say, some files are much larger than others, and some files you'd expect to find don't even exist. It doesn't matter whether you've had a specific experience one time or 10 times. When Miss Claudie opens a file, all of your past thoughts and feelings associated with that dominant energy come rushing to the surface. We call the outcome of this mental process remembering. Now, here's the kicker. Some things that get filed away aren't even yours. Things you hear, see, or feel, whether or not they have anything to do with you, end up in some file in your brain. Unfortunately, while Miss Claudie may be very good at putting stuff in files, she isn't always particularly accurate. I'm not blaming Miss Claudie for the unpleasant, negative, or traumatic memories that get stored in our brains. She is simply doing her divinely assigned work. The brain sorts and categorizes and stores everything. That is simply how the brain functions. The challenge we all face includes shifting how we interpret our experiences so that the energies we hold onto, which are associated with those experiences, do not further expand our already bulging dominant negative thought files. Thoughts and images control the mind. Whether pleasant or unpleasant, conscious or unconscious, our dominant thoughts deepen the imprints of specific thought patterns and expand their related files. Miss Claudie's file categories and our propensity to get stuck in the negative explain why our minds will focus on negative experiences so much more than on the positive ones. The files containing negative thoughts, feelings, and experiences are simply larger than those containing positive thoughts, feelings, and experiences. Reducing our dominant negative thought files requires consistently acting, thinking, and speaking in a positive fashion. What you focus on grows. According to Dr. Ellen Weber of the MITA International Brain Center, the brain is equipped to change rapidly and biologically reshape itself. The process called neuroplasticity, one of the most popular areas of research in psychology today, refers to the brain's ability to restructure itself after training or practice. This scientific research is great news. It can also be the primary motivation for you to make the commitment to engage the get over it thought therapy process. Your brain can be reprogrammed. Hallelujah. So no matter how dysfunctional you may think you are, no matter how much trauma you may have endured, there is a way out if you are willing to do the work. Neuroplasticity is what makes personal growth and mental development possible at the most basic level. With the understanding that change is indeed possible, we are now able to focus on the ways in which you'd like to grow. Miss Claudie has done all of the foundational work on your behalf. She created the files, the memories that have made you who you are today. However, Miss Claudie's files are not all of who you are, nor is it who and what you must remain. When it comes to who you believe you are and who you might become, Miss Claudie doesn't have a file for that yet because you have not provided this new information. Today is the day to begin doing the work required to attach new sensations to old words, to give new definitions to old sensations. Miss Claudie will be happy to create the necessary new files. Chapter 2, The 4 A's, Awareness, Acknowledgement, Acceptance, and Action. The ancestor of every action is a thought. Ralph Waldo Emerson. If you ever want to become aware, perhaps painfully aware, of what you are thinking and the patterns present in your mind, look at your life. Look at the condition of your home environment, the people with whom you have fulfilling or not so fulfilling relationships, the experiences you seem destined to repeat over and over, the job you go to day in and day out, the status of your bank account. Now consider what you believe is missing in your life. Everything you are experiencing is a function of your files or what you are thinking. Another way to increase your awareness of your dominant negative thought patterns is to closely examine what you think about other people. Here is a series of truths that is often difficult for people to recognize or accept. If you can see it out there, it exists or has at some point existed within you. Some of what you see, you have been or don't want to be. Most of what you see, you believe you are. All of what you see out there in the world or attached to other people is a thought that is already present in your mind. I give meaning to everything I see is a lesson from A Course in Miracles. It can be translated to mean the following. I see it because I recognize it. I recognize it because I believe I am it. Because I believe I am it, the ego demands that I hide it or make it all about you. Making your life conditions and experiences about something or someone other than yourself trumps the truth that thoughts, not people, create the intimate and personal conditions of your life. Once upon a time when I was an average human being who had done no personal development or emotional healing work, I was clueless about my dominant negative thoughts. I suffered from what I called Trumpitis, thoughts that reoccurred at a rapid pace motivating certain impulsive behaviors. Remember, every thought has a feeling or a memory attached to it. Whether a thought triggers a feeling or a feeling generates a thought really doesn't matter. What matters is becoming aware of how the energy of a thought-feeling combo motivates behavior and generates certain expectations. What matters is knowing that there are mental files governing your life. What matters is learning how to use 4 powerful spiritual principles to support you in identifying and hopefully eliminating your dominant negative thought patterns. Putting the 4 A's into practice. Awareness, acknowledgement, acceptance, and action. The four A's are the four spiritual building blocks that, when used appropriately, can help us move through upsets, challenges, and detours created by how and what we think. They can help counterbalance and neutralize the unconscious habitual demands of the ego that feed on dominant negative thought patterns and open our minds to new ways of thinking and being. The four A's capture the essence of a simple prayer I have learned to say when my mind is running amok. Dear Lord, help me see this rightly. Let there be light. The four A's are designed to alert you to the hidden dominant negative thought patterns that are influencing the tides of your life experience. This does not mean you have done or are doing anything wrong. This is simply an effort to support you in becoming conscious of what you are thinking so that you can choose to change your mind. Awareness. Awareness, like everything else, is subject to the laws of natural order. In other words, you must be aware something exists before you can choose to do something about it. The natural order of life never takes us into experiences we are not equipped to handle. Those are experiences to which we contribute with no awareness of our doing so. As we become aware of our defenses, excuses, rationales, limiting beliefs, and misinterpretations of reality, we are equipped to make better choices. Awareness of our strengths can minimize the impact of our weaknesses. In all life experiences, awareness that what you are doing is not bringing forth the desired results serves as a divine intervention in support of healing and growth. Even when the issue pattern or wound to be healed is unpleasant or painful, awareness is the precursor to acknowledgement. The flip side of awareness is denial, a resistance to knowing and becoming aware. As a principle of healing, awareness also opens the energy of the heart. It makes us more compassionate because it reminds us of our human weaknesses and frailties. Once the heart is open, the natural flow of life transforms awareness into the knowledge and understanding required to move beyond the places in which we are stuck, the patterns of thought, belief, and behavior that create and recreate painful experiences. In the healing process, awareness makes us more compassionate towards ourselves and others because it provides the information we need to make self-supportive and conscious decisions. Acknowledgement. Acknowledgement is the first step toward healing because it moves awareness to a higher level. Once you become aware that something exists, you are required to acknowledge your awareness. Acknowledgement is, therefore, the conscious and/or verbal recognition of what you know and understand now. It is an act of courageous ownership that requires a willingness to tell the radical truth about what is going on and your role in the unfolding events. To acknowledge means that you recognize a thing for what it is. You own it as a conscious or unconscious creation. Until and unless we acknowledge something, we cannot and will not be able to unravel or heal the details of the experience. Acknowledgement takes us beyond the dramatic details of our story and down into the nitty-gritty of our role in whatever is being revealed to us about ourselves. As an empowering healing principle, acknowledgement is about leveraging our awareness and owning what we have or have not done, even when we may not understand what motivated that behavior or choice. Our behaviors and choices are our contributions to our experiences. Regardless of what we may say we need, want, or desire at any given moment, what shows up in our lives as our experience is what we think and feel about those things. Until we become aware of and acknowledge our contributions, we blame, feel victimized, and cling to powerlessness. Acknowledgement is a declaration of our unconscious dominant negative thought patterns that are hidden beneath the surface and must ultimately be accepted to be healed. Acceptance. While we may not like what is going on, while it may be difficult, uncomfortable, or downright painful, there comes a point when we must simply admit that what shows up in our lives is a function of our thoughts. The most common alternatives to acceptance are fear, resistance, denial, and againstness. Each of these serves to make a difficult experience more difficult. Fear will motivate you to lie about what you know. Resistance will motivate you to justify what you think and feel. Denial will lead you away from ownership into victimization, and againstness will motivate you to fight to be right when you are absolutely dead wrong. Acceptance means resolve, not resignation. Resolve leads to victory, while resignation makes us victims. Resolve is the higher vibratory position of, this is what it is. I am going to learn from it and move through it with dignity and ease. When we're resigned, we adopt a position of powerlessness or helplessness, meaning, oh well, this happened to me and there's nothing else I can do. Acceptance does not mean agreement, nor does it mean we feel good about what we are facing. It does, however, mean that we are willing to look for and embrace the lesson. It also indicates a willingness to grow through the experience by understanding something bigger, which we may not recognize just yet, is unfolding for our benefit. Action. Remember, no matter what shows up, there is always something we can do, some action we can take to advance our healing, growth, and learning. In most cases, awareness, acknowledgement, and acceptance will take the sting out of an experience and get you to where you need to be. In other cases, you will be required to do or not do something to evolve and come out on the other end of an experience unscathed. If you can acknowledge your role in an experience and accept that you are healing and learning the truth about your own dominant thought patterns, you will be guided to act and take your next most appropriate steps. Learning and using the 4 A's is one of the most effective methods for tuning into and eliminating your DNTPs. You do this by learning to pay attention to what you are thinking and the feelings being generated by your thoughts. Once you become aware that a DNTP has been triggered through evidence or experience, acknowledge it to yourself. Then, accept whatever thought, behavior pattern is operating and prepare to act. In this way, the get-over process will work for you and through you almost like magic. The unhappy hours. Consider the tale of Christy and Bruce. Because Christy had no knowledge of the 4 A's, Miss Claudie had to spend countless overtime hours sorting and filing the mountain of disowned DNTPs generated during the unhappy hours. Christy met Bruce at her favorite bar's happy hour. Not only was he good looking, he was the first guy she had met in a long time who seemed to want more than sex. After they exchanged numbers, he called when he said he would, and their conversations were quite stimulating and fun. Christy refused to allow herself to get too excited too quickly because she knew that happy hour guys just cannot be trusted. Bruce was a new experience for Christy. She had no mental file in which to place the experience she was having, so instead, her experience triggered old thoughts and feelings. She thought about the other guys she had met in bars. She thought about how foul and nasty those experiences had been. She thought about how she kept hoping against hope that each one would be the one, only to be disappointed when she got exactly what she had gotten previously. Triggered by her memories, these thoughts were so strong that they blinded her to her current reality and the possibility that Bruce could actually be a really nice guy. Each thought trigger that came into Christy's mind also had a feeling attached to it. For Christy, those feelings included fear of being wrong again, disappointment with herself for not being able to attract the right guy, and cynicism, which for her sounded like, here comes another one, just like the other one. Like most of us, Christy was totally unaware that she had been triggered and was therefore digging through the old files that held all of her beliefs about herself in relationship to men. After all, she had file cabinets full of evidence. She had been there, done that, and had it done to her more times than she cared to remember. Unfortunately, she did remember, and that was the problem. It is clear that Christy's DNTP about never finding the right man had been triggered. So rather than paying close attention to how Bruce was being with her, she was engaged in her thoughts about him. Thought triggers, those things you are inclined to believe will always be true, can serve as your DNTP smoke detectors. They warn that a particular thought is about to catch fire. If you let the fire start due to lack of awareness, you risk having your house burned down. Christy was totally aware of the five-alarm fire raging in her mind, so she kept dating Bruce because she just refused to be wrong again. Remember, thinking one thing, feeling something else, and behaving in a manner that is incongruent with what you think and what you feel is the stuff that makes suffering normal. They had been on three dates before Bruce asked if he could kiss her goodnight. After that first kiss, Bruce told her that he liked her a lot and hoped that they could build something solid between them. Christy was floored, that is, excited, because things seemed promising. And at the same time, suspicious, that means mistrustful, because thought triggers that contradicted what she was feeling had been activated. Her DNTP was about to singe the memories scattered around her mind. She told him that she hoped that they could too, but that she always lived by the 90-day rule. No sex for the first 90 days in a new relationship. He agreed that would be a great way for them to really get to know each other, and he was ready to give it a try. The 3 months flew by with standing Tuesday and Thursday night dates, lots of laughter and many deep conversations. Bruce appeared to be a nice guy, and he seemed to be into her, but Christy was still leery about his true intentions. She had been down this road before. Larry, she had discovered after a year of dating, had been married. Douglas had had two other women on the side, and her ex-husband had a secret gambling problem that left her bankrupt and heartbroken. How had she managed to find such a nice guy after a series of losers? Christy and Bruce dated for almost 7 months before they were intimate. Despite her ongoing reservations, by the third time Bruce spent the night, Christy had met his family and knew about all his exes. Yet, she was still determined to discover what he was really up to. Christy was nobody's fool, she boasted to her friends, and she was determined to protect herself from any more unhappy endings. One night, while Bruce was sleeping, Christy decided to do a pocket search and a phone check. His pockets were empty, and his telephone was password protected. But in his wallet, she found a credit card with a woman's name on it. Bullseye. This was all Christy needed to justify her suspicions. On the next date, when Bruce reached for his wallet to pay the check, Christy snatched it out of his hand, rummaged through it, looking for the credit card. Unable to find it, she asked him in a not-so-polite voice, "Why don't you pay for it with her card?" "What the F are you talking about?" Bruce said, stunned and embarrassed. "Oh, so he curses too," Christy thought to herself. "That's new." "You know exactly what I'm talking about. I saw a card in your wallet with a woman's name on it. Who is she? Where is that card?" "You searched my wallet?" After the initial shock, Bruce was more sad than angry. "You're damn right I did. I tried to get into your telephone, too, but it was locked." "Come on, Christy," he hissed. "Let me take you home." "F you. I'll take Uber." Christy stood up and walked away, then disappeared into the ladies' room. Bruce, still at the table, gaped after her. 15 minutes later, when she darted for the door, Bruce stepped in front of her and said, "I am not that guy, Christy. I brought you here, and I will take you home." His voice was so calm, gentle, yet commanding, that Christy felt obligated to follow him to the car. They rode to her front door in silence. After he stopped the car and turned the motor off, he reached for her hand and said, "Christy, I know your story, and I promise you, I am not that guy. Whoever hurt you, I promise you, I am not him." Feeling somewhat foolish and extremely self-conscious, Christy replied, "I just don't know if I can trust you. I want to, but at the same time, I'm afraid." "I know," he said, "but I've never given you any reason not to trust me. The real issue now is whether I can trust you now that I know that you've searched my wallet." The night was over. Christy didn't hear from Bruce for 3 days. She wanted to call him, but she didn't. When he did call, she expected him to act like nothing had happened. That was how all of her exes had behaved. But his actions confirmed that just as he said, he was not that guy. He asked to meet her so they could discuss what had happened and where they could go from here. He got right to it. The card was in his ex's name. They were still good friends, so they shared the account. He paid his portion, and she paid hers. That was all there was to it. As he described it, he had been lazy about getting the card transferred into his name, and it was a way to show that there were no ill feelings between them. The account was 6 years old, and they had never had a problem. Bruce said that the real issue for him was the violation of his boundaries and Christy's lack of trust. He did not want to move forward in a relationship with a woman who did not trust him, even after he had demonstrated that he was trustworthy. He had nothing to hide, but he did not like having been searched and interrogated. He liked her a lot and wanted so much more for them, but Christy had crossed the line, and he didn't believe he could get beyond that. Christy apologized and said she understood. She explained the mistake had stemmed from her fear and assured him it would never happen again. She asked for his forgiveness and wondered if they could try again. Bruce listened, accepted her apology, and told her he would have to get back to her. With that, he left enough money to pay for their drinks, kissed her on the cheek, and departed. Christy was stunned and just a wee bit pissed off. One mistake, one stupid mistake, and this was how he responded? WTF! If she meant so much to him, why couldn't they just move on? If she was that disposable, he must be up to something. If he was that unforgiving, maybe she didn't want him. Resigned to wait and see, Christy went home, where she wept for the next 2 weeks. Moving from shock to anger to total denial, Christy waited a respectable month before she called Bruce. To her surprise, he picked up on the second ring. His voice was calm as usual. She thought that was a good sign. He was fine. He had been thinking about her and had just been waiting to be as clear as possible before contacting her. Boundaries, honesty, and trust were important to him. He understood where she was coming from, and it was not a place where he wanted to live. His concern was, what would be next? He had done everything in his power to be a demonstration of what he believed and of how he lived his life, yet her behavior was an indication that she wasn't ready, and he wasn't willing to endure whatever might come along with her getting ready. No hard feelings. She was a beautiful woman. He had enjoyed their time together, but the relationship was not going to work for him. Without so much as a word in reply, Christy hung up. The next 3 months were nothing short of brutal. Christy didn't understand how Bruce could be so direct and uncaring. 7 months together, and he cut her off just like that? Where was his compassion, his understanding? Most of Christy's girlfriends agreed, but there was one, there's always one, who tries to make sense out of the incomprehensible, who saw things differently. Angie suggested they apply the 4 A's to the situation. She helped Christy to become aware of and acknowledge how her own thoughts had led her to search Bruce's wallet. It had been totally uncalled for, and it had been a violation of his boundaries. Obviously, Bruce was a man of integrity, an honest man who held a line on what was and was not acceptable. He had given her no reason to be suspicious. It was Christy's fear of repeating old patterns that had prompted her to make that move. Bruce's ending of the relationship was his way of taking steps to protect himself, just as Christy had taken steps when she thought she needed to be protected from him. At first, Christy just couldn't see it. It took many conversations before she bumped into her dominant negative thought patterns. Men cannot be trusted, and she would never find the right guy. Once she acknowledged her DNTPs, she could finally admit how crazy she had been. Being so brutally honest with herself wasn't easy. She admitted she'd always been listening for some contradiction, always waiting for him to break a promise. She had even stalked his apartment twice, waiting to see if he came home alone. After several discussions with her posse, Christy admitted and accepted that she had expected Bruce to behave badly, and when he didn't, she did. OMG. There was nothing to do, they said, beyond recognizing her fears and working to do better next time. What if there was no next time? What if she had blown the best thing that would ever happen for her? Angie, her reasonable, rational friend, assured her that life doesn't work like that. Life is a learn-as-you-go process. As we learn, we do better. Bruce had made his decision, and it would be foolish and risky for her to try to convince him to change his mind. Acknowledging and accepting the error of her ways would open new doors for her. Forgiving herself would help her avoid making the same mistakes in the future. It wasn't wrong to be cautious, but she also had to pay attention to the actual signs she received. Life provides us an endless supply of do-overs. If you mess up the first time, you'll get another chance. Angie assured Christy that if she continued to do her work, moving through the fear, cleaning up her thoughts and expectations, things would change. In the moment, it was hard for Christy to take it all in. She blamed herself and beat herself up and down for another 3 months. Finally, she moved into a space of acceptance. It was over and done. She wished Bruce well. She even decided to send him a thank you note, expressing her gratitude to him for showing her the importance of trust and for holding his boundaries with such strength and clarity. She told him that she was doing fine and that she wished him well. 2 weeks later, he called and asked if she would meet him at happy hour. He thought that maybe they could start fresh. You must do the work. Christy's friend Angie had walked her through the 4 A's process, explaining that the 4 A's are the foundation of one's A game. Functioning as a kind of get-over-it jujitsu, they allow you to disarm your immediate experience rapidly so that you will become aware of and identify the roots of your DNTPs. For Christy, Bruce triggered the file of past relationships and the negative experiences she dreaded. Remember, we are much more prone to recall our negative experiences than our positive ones. They send a stronger energetic sensation or feeling through the body. While these are the experiences we desperately want to avoid, we unwittingly rehearse them mentally. By thinking about what we don't want or what we will not do, in effect, we deepen the emotional and psychological impressions that exist and in turn open one of the files in our mind. The mental rehearsal, the constant rehashing of the meanings we have given to past thoughts, feelings, and experiences, is what adds ever more data to those bulging negative files. Then, when an extraordinarily new and fearful thought triggers us, we are left spinning in extreme emotional distress and overreaction, like going through someone's wallet when he's asleep. That Angie was a very wise woman. She was able to help Christy recognize her own thoughts and feelings that had nothing to do with Bruce. That awareness was a giant step forward for Christy. Then, by acknowledging and accepting the truth about her own behaviors and overreactions, Christy demonstrated her willingness to have a new experience. Finally, by engaging in the completely loving action of forgiving herself and expressing gratitude toward Bruce, Christy, in effect, freed her mind from her hidden DNTPs. There can be no doubt that this breakthrough left Miss Claudie beaming. Chapter 3, Troubled Minds, A Family History. Every thought you produce, anything you say, any action you do, it bears your signature. Fit not harm. What you think and how you think are not private matters. Since thoughts determine how we approach and respond to life, everyone in our sphere will become familiar with the state of our mind. The people we spend the most time with will come to learn our likes and dislikes, our propensities, and our probable responses in any given situation. Statements such as, "You know how she is," or "You know he's not going to like that," are in essence testimonies given by our loved ones that indicate just how aware they are of our habitual patterns of thought. Our dominant thought patterns tell people a lot about us, and our thought patterns often determine how others behave around us. More important, how those people around us think, that is, their dominant negative thought patterns, will also have a definite impact on us. Bloodline equals a line of thoughts. Some of us grew up in families and environments that were desperately dysfunctional and emotionally destructive. This was the case with Alan. He is the son of a 16-year-old high school student with a slight learning disability and a 17-year-old high school dropout. Alan's mother, Rose, lived with her mother, Annie Brown, who herself had been a teenage mother. Alan's birth brought to life and light an entrenched generational family history of dominant negative thought patterns and the results that follow when an entire family remains unconscious of them. Rose was never a little girl. At age 16, she stood 5'9" tall and carried about 50 extra pounds. So it didn't seem at all odd that she wore her clothing, extra large, to hide her fluffy stomach. Rose hid her fluffy stomach pregnancy well because she was terrified of her mother's reaction. When Annie decided to take her daughter to Planned Parenthood for birth control, it didn't seem unusual. In Annie's mind, she was doing for her daughter what no one had done for her. She knew that young girls who grew up in fatherless households faced terrible temptations, and she wanted to protect Rose from the potential result of giving in to those temptations, an unwanted pregnancy. As a cautious and realistic parent, Annie knew that her many lectures to Rose about no sex and safe sex would mean very little when her daughter encountered seductive propositions from the neighborhood boys. She was determined that Rose would not repeat her history. The day of their appointment at Planned Parenthood, however, Annie learned that Rose was already 35 weeks pregnant. The soon-to-be grandmother and mother-to-be were living in a friend's house where Annie, who was unemployed at the time, was scrambling to pay weekly rent and buy food. Annie's older daughter, Bev, a college freshman with very little financial support, was also part of the struggling extended family. Bev had made it through her first two semesters of college by charging other students a small fee to braid their hair. When that was no longer sufficient to sustain her, Bev dropped out of college, returned home, and got a job at McDonald's. She had learned from her mother, Annie, that you do whatever you have to do to take care of those you love, even when it means putting your dreams on hold. An unplanned pregnancy and another mouth to feed were the last things the Brown family needed. In this family, there's never enough was not only the dominant negative thought pattern in everyone's mental files, it was also a physical reality. Needless to say, after the revelation of Rose's condition at Planned Parenthood, Annie lost it. It wasn't so much the screaming and swearing that impacted Rose. It was Annie's relentless shaming and belittling of her terrified daughter that deepened in Rose's brain the DNP imprints and the family patterns of guilt, fear, and humiliation. And Annie wasn't reacting so much to the knowledge that Rose had been sexually active. Annie was livid that Rose had lied to her, covered up her pregnancy for months, and put the entire family in jeopardy. This was exactly what Rose had felt when she had been pregnant and abandoned as a 16-year-old. Annie was so upset. Did Rose feel the baby moving? Did she understand the importance of prenatal care? They had no medical coverage. The earliest prenatal appointment Annie could get for Rose was 2 weeks out. What did Rose mean that she didn't want to be on welfare? And who was the father? Where was he? Thank God he wasn't the son of one of the neighbors. Annie offered her pregnant daughter no compassion, no support, no guidance, and no counseling. Rose's mind and the atmosphere in the household were thick, with an overabundance of emotional abandonment and absolute uncontrollable rage during her son's womb time. Welcome to the world, baby boy. Alan was born 2 weeks and 2 days after the family discovered that Rose was pregnant, on Memorial Day that year. After 23 hours of labor, Alan made his appearance, 6 pounds, 19 inches, 19 inches long. Mother, grandmother, and auntie welcomed Alan with kisses and prayers. He was a beautiful baby. Family friends made sure he had everything he needed, from diapers to a stroller, from a high chair to a used bassinet. Although receiving those items for Alan was a blessing, both Rose and Annie felt embarrassed to need anything from anyone. Alan's formula was made the old-fashioned way, with evaporated milk and Karo syrup in the sterilizer. It wasn't the optimal choice, but the family had a history of making do with what they had and not expecting more. Alan wore cloth diapers because Pampers weren't even on the market in poor neighborhoods at that time. Rose eventually shared her baby's daddy's name with her mother, but mysteriously, he could not be located, not even after Annie contacted the school. No such student had ever been enrolled. Annie wasn't surprised. She had grown up in a family where men had always disappeared when they were needed. Annie was adamant that Rose should complete her junior year of high school. So Rose spent the first 2 weeks after the birth at home with her new baby, then resumed classes. In her absence, Auntie Bev became Alan's primary caregiver. While Rose did her homework, Grandma and Auntie shared the child care duties. And at every opportunity, Grandma pointed out to Rose what she needed to be doing, what she wasn't doing, and what she should be doing as far as baby Alan was concerned. Annie's constant corrections and criticism were the manifestation of a multi-generational pattern related to parental irresponsibility, personal inferiority, and the inadequacy of women within the Brown family. Nighttime in the Brown household made it clear to everyone that a serious problem was brewing between mother and son. The fear, shame, and guilt surrounding her pregnancy ordeal had made bonding with Alan impossible for Rose. She would let her son cry for hours until his auntie came to rescue him. Annie would lie awake in her bed, pretending she didn't hear her grandbaby crying or her daughters arguing. It wasn't a new experience for her. She had learned how to do that, ignore what was going on around her, in her childhood home where domestic violence had been an everyday affair. Alan's cries for attention and nurturing must have triggered memories from his womb time. His mother's painful emotional experiences during his formative development, when his very existence had been a terrible secret, had riddled his energy system with holes. It's not easy being a pregnant teenager under any circumstances. However, when the young mother is tormented by fear, guilt, and shame, an unplanned pregnancy can only escalate her incredibly vulnerable state of mind and being. Rose had no support during her pregnancy, a time of significant hormonal, physiological, and psychological shifts in a woman's being. Along with the weight gain, mood swings, physical cravings, and discomforts, Rose had been consumed with negative thoughts and feelings designed to keep two people in hiding rather than just one. Some stuff you bring with you. In the case of an expected pregnancy, preparations are made for the baby as well as for the life of the future family. There is also, hopefully, some joy and excitement surrounding the promise of a new life. Yet, in Alan's case, and the case of so many others, there was no planning or welcome. Assaulted by a myriad of toxic emotions and generational poverty, Alan started life behind the eight ball. In the womb, he took on the physiological, psychological, and emotional experience of his mother. These direct hits landed like energetic bombs and were deeply imprinted into the fibers of his being. Scientific research has confirmed that a woman's nutritional condition, psychological states, and emotional propensities do in fact influence the predisposition of the children she gives birth to. Such susceptibilities often manifest as low self-esteem, a diminished state of self-value, and a lack of self-worth later in life. Alan gestated in a toxic womb and was born into a physically and psychologically stressed environment. The deck was stacked against him. It would be a real toss-up, though, to decide which was worse, what happened before he was born or what happened once he came into life. When Alan was two, Grandma Annie moved to a new state and took her grandson with her. Annie's plan was to give Rose the opportunity to finish training as a nursing assistant. Once she completed the program,